Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have John Galloway. John, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. I love that delay, so it sounds like you're over the satellite. And with us is Pete Brown. Pete Brown is an evangelist for Microsoft in the client and devices team. He's my former boss at Microsoft. He is a truly cool gadget guy. And Pete, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. What the audience cannot see, but we can because we're on Skype, is the gizmos and dials and switches, and just it looks like you belong in a serious rock band is what it looks like.
Yeah. It's different from the minimalist thing that John has going on behind him where I see a wall. Yes. He's got like this giant beige wall and there's like one tiny little plaque in the middle of it back there. By the way, John's also a cool guy too. Just, you know,
he's a cool guy, but he's on the show a lot, so I can't keep saying how he's one of my favorite people.
I just have to say that little plaque on the wall behind me is actually, it's a needlepoint my daughter sewed, and it has a companion cube and it says Portal 2 over it. And
that she's so
yeah, and she hand stitched it. But of course I yelled at her because I said the companion cube was never in Portal 2. And what? Don't bring me this rubbish. Like, this is just messed up.
Yes, good parenting. So excellent.
So she hasn't shown me anything since then.
Well, there's a weighted companion cube in Portal 2. I was pretty sure of that, right?
No? I don't think so. No. So yeah, you would have made the
throw
same
her
mistake.
Out.
And before we get into all the stuff I want to talk about, you have an even more impressive looking mic than many of the others I've seen. What are you talking into?
Why, it's my giant mic. So I've just got tons of audio gear here. So what is this? This is a Shure SM7B, I believe, right? So it's the one that I've been happiest with so far, and I've got it running through lots and lots of wires because each wire that I run it through adds additional flavor to the sound, right?
Yes. So, and that's not a USB mic, right? That's a real pro mic.
No, this is not one of those little funny USB mics that, you know, the amateurs are using, right? This is a real mic. No, I used to use one of those, but I have, I've got what, 1, 2, 3, 4, I don't know, probably around 6 or 7 full hubs attached to my computer here. So trying to pipe audio through with the rest of that was probably not going to be a reasonable thing.
You can chain 128 devices, right? They did that at Build.
Oh, good segue. Now we can talk about Build. That was the geek portion of our show. Moving on into the coding and programming, you were both at Build. I'm very jealous. I didn't get to go to Build this year.
Yeah,
exactly. And one of the things that happened at Build that I'm particularly interested in was 8.1, so I want to talk about that. But I also hear that you moved your blog to Azure. So let's talk about both of those things.
Sure. So don't be so jealous of John and I. Our view of Build was like if you close your eyes and then like punch yourself in the head a couple of times so you see like little flashes of light. That was basically our view of Build from backstage the whole time. Because, you know, we had that to help with the like, John, I know you were back there a bunch with Hanselman stuff and it was pretty crazy. But it was like after being back there for a week, you emerged out into San Francisco and it was like daylight and eyes are squinting and it's like coming out of a cave.
But, the backstage is funny. It's all these racks of computers and screens and then wires everywhere. So it kind of looks like, I don't know, the rebel base on Hoth or something.
Yeah, that's totally what it looks like.
And then there's all these curtains separating things, which almost feel like tents or something. I don't know. It's really crazy.
Yeah, but last year you got, Pete, you got to hang out with the keyboard guy from Dream Theater, which...
Yes, which was cool. So I helped with the keynote. Like, you know, the team that I'm on wrote Googs and John Chuchuk's keynote for day two. But also I got the DJ this year as well. So I keep finding myself lining up entertainment for Build. So last year, you know, I brought in Jordan Rudess for some stuff. And then this year I brought in a guy named Deadbeat. not his actual name, by the way, from Berlin, who is a DJ that uses Windows and does all of his work there on Windows to do both day one and day two. And I'm trying to get the recording of his performances because Channel 9 didn't post them live like they did last time. But he did a great job with that and saw lots of great feedback from that as well.
Well, to give you some idea of how old I have become, last year you said to me, do you know Dream Theater? And I was like, I think I've heard of it. And I went home and my daughter said, you have all their albums, fool. Gives you some idea of how I'm doing.
You know, since I've stopped having a rack of CDs along the wall or the big, I used to have those drawers full of tapes. Mm-hmm. You know, since I've done away with that, it's hard for me to keep track of what I actually have music wise and not, because you don't just turn around and see a whole wall taken up by this stuff anymore.
Right. Yeah, or I was going to ask, tapes, what's trunk. An album?
Yeah, now, yeah, now individual songs and stuff, right? And then it's kind of funny because the only reason I don't have tapes anymore is because when I moved, for some reason, they made their way into my car trunk and then they just stayed there for like a year until my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, made me throw them out. She's like, you don't need tapes anymore. But it's like, it's White Lion. It's still going to be cool, you know, and stuff.
Okay,
like that.
If you're into this stuff, before we get back on topic, I just finished Brian Ferry's How Music Works, and I highly recommend it. It's a little bit about music. It's a lot about music. It's also a lot about the industry and his experience with the Talking Heads and Brian Eno and how pricing works and how studios work. It's a very, very cool book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's probably stuff that'll make you hate the music industry after reading it, right?
Well, I don't know. It's a mixed bag. So, yeah. So Build,
yes.
And Azure.
Azure,
and
right?
8.1.
Okay, so what you're trying to do is get us back on topic. I'm so sorry.
Any topic. Pick a topic.
Pick any topic. So Build was awesome, right? So this was my first time being that involved in it, and I had a great time, you know, helping to work on the keynote and stuff. But then I also got to see some of the practices for, you know, the other folks' keynotes and, you know, get a heads up of what was going to be announced there, which I was a huge deal for me because most people, we don't really know what everybody is going to announce at Build until you're essentially there. Like, we know what's in the bits and all the stuff there. But seeing things like Lego, like the Lego robots in the day one keynote, and then one of my favorite things, 3D printing in the day one keynote, were two like really big highlights for me of that event. So do you guys have do you have a 3D printer yet, Jesse?
No, I don't.
No, oh, all right.
I don't either. And
well, my
I've
printer
been...
is three dimensional. I don't have a 2D printer.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I've been
touché, sir.
Now I'm totally hooked on the idea. I've been pricing them out and stuff, and they're still way too much. Well, but I'm seeing they're coming down prices. I'm seeing things like Kickstarter and that kind of thing in the $500-$400 range now.
I mean, you remember laser printers when they first came out? I mean, when they first came out, yes. They were huge and cost like 10 grand. But when they started becoming more popular, there was still like $1,200, $1,300 for a laser printer. And then like the 3D printing stuff now is somewhere in the $1,300, like the commercial stuff, in the $1,300 to $2,700 range for consumer-focused things. And then it's like 25 grand and higher for, you know, the real kind of corporate stuff. But Staples is going to sell the one that costs, I think, around $1,300, right? So you're going to be able to go into Staples and buy a 3D printer, which is certainly going to help for, you know, adoption. And then our own Microsoft stores are going to be selling the MakerBot, which is around, for that one, I think it was around $2,500 or $2,600, somewhere around there. But really, really great, you know, resolution on it and some really cool things. But the reason that we're doing that is because we added in API support in Windows for 3D printing. So it's sort of analogous to the driver support and stuff we do for 2D printing or flat printing to 3D printers, however you want to talk about it, Jesse. So we're doing kind of the same thing there. So to me, that says that's going to push it more to the consumer side, and that'll make the prices come way down.
And what can I print with a 3D printer after I print a couple toys?
You can print a couple more toys. I actually use, I was trying to see if I had it around here somewhere, not that your listeners are going to see it, but I actually used a 3D printer in part of the keynote where here's the super secret stuff, right? On the day two keynote, right, with Googs and stuff, we had a demo of Windows Embedded, right? And so we had the Windows Embedded devices for, you know, Windows Embedded 8 itself, like the tablet version of it. So we had the right devices there. But on the phone side, we couldn't get the embedded devices in time. So what happened is we were able to install the operating system on just a regular Windows phone, right? So it's got the embedded stuff on it and all the right bits on the phone. Has access to all the right APIs. But the problem was it was just a regular phone, right? And it's like, nobody's going to believe us that this is embedded. So we took a look at what the other phones are supposed to look like, and I was able to 3D print a case that went around those phones and made them look beefier just so you weren't immediately looking at that and saying, oh, that's a retail phone, right? So, you know, we had all the right software and everything, but we just didn't have the devices ready yet at that time because the ones that Avis is going to be using, I believe, won't be out until later this year or early next year or something like that.
You know, the whole 3D printing thing is like you were asking Jesse about, you know, what the feel of it's like. And we've all been to conferences and stuff. That was one thing that felt very different was walking around the big room, the expo floor or whatever you call it. They had tons of 3D printers sitting out there and stuff was just printing all the time. They had all these things scattered around and you could watch and they're printing out these bright colored things, and one, you know, they're printing out like chess pieces and some of the things they printed were things that you couldn't, like, they were only possible because they were 3D printed, kind of, you know, like,
right.
There were things that you couldn't have the different separate parts and snap them together. They were separate parts that were all printed already assembled, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so they had things like gears that are already meshed together but inside a container, and you could only do that by 3D printing or by printing or by somehow creating multiple pieces and gluing them together. So 3D printing is something that has been very hobbyist oriented right now. You know, it's either like the big design shops that are doing it for prototyping, or it's just like hobby guys that are doing it just to print stuff for the heck of it. Or those people that are printing gun parts and all sorts of strange things like that. But I think with this, we're going to start seeing a lot more consumers getting involved in it. And I think, you know, I don't know how many years it's going to be, but we're going to start seeing these things in people's living rooms and like on their kitchen table. And when the kid's trying to do some sort of science project, he's going to be printing out the parts that he needs to show, you know, motion or show how gears mesh together or anything like that. So I think it's just going to become a natural part of what we do. And I was really excited and proud to see that we're on top of that. So
I like that vision of, you know, that you finally gave me something I can connect to of a kid putting together a science project, putting together a DNA model or gears or a small physics problem or whatever. That I can imagine going mainstream in a big way.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
the idea of seeing the future a little bit. And you know, I was talking to my daughter the other day and saying when I was growing up, my dad owned a print shop. And she's like, why would people go to a store to print something? Like, she just didn't get it. And I was explaining, you know, well, back then, you know, they didn't. And, you know, this was even before Kinko's and all this stuff. But now everyone has a printer in their house. And the same kind of thing, I thought of that when I was seeing these 3D printers everywhere. And I was thinking, like, this is the future. Like, these are going to be everywhere. And it's going to change not just like, well, I could print out a toy, but just all kinds of things. You could download something, maybe pay a few dollars for it and print it, you know, off your computer and not even leave your house ever.
<There you go.
laughs> Which is the goal, right?
Yeah. So they do make printers that can 3D print food, but you sort of have to have like, it's like pastries and weird stuff like that. So I'm not sure that that's worth it, but you could in theory have it produce everything for you and you never leave ever.
Mm-hmm. Returning from the land of science fiction. I personally was blasted by Windows 8.1. I thought that it deserved actually a bigger number, like 8.5, because there were some very significant enhancements and improvements and changes. And let's ignore the whole thing about the start button. There was a lot of really good stuff in there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you just came out with your new book, which we should talk about because it's great. And how much do those changes affect the way we're going to do programming for the platform?
Sure. So it is interesting that we're calling it Windows 8.1. And I think a lot of people are erroneously thinking of that as a service pack. And, you know, they obviously don't see kind of like what's going on behind the scenes. But service packs are developed by entirely different teams, and it's sort of like more the sustained engineering work and everything else. Whereas 8.1 was developed by core Windows teams at just like any other version of any operating system that we've worked on. So it was a very significant update. I think it really kind of polished a lot of stuff that was a little rough in Windows 8. You know, it made a lot of the interactions easier. You know, it changed the windowing format so you can have these continually variable window sizes for splitting the screen, especially useful on tablets. I mean, desktop people look at that and say, okay, yeah, that's wonderful. But really, if you think about this interaction with modern apps on a tablet, especially if you're doing something like working in Mail and click on a link and want to have it open up the browser, that new windowing model is a big deal.
Yes.
It's also a bit of a step back from what we did before. It's really one of those things where we went through and saw, how people were using the snap view and what they were doing with that 320 pixels, and found that in many cases, an app couldn't do anything particularly useful in 320 pixels. So they just kind of left it blank or didn't support it. So by making it continually variable, I think that makes a much bigger difference to developers, app developers out there. Now, the hard part of that is, yes, there is one section in my book, and thanks for the plug, which is entirely on the view states, snapped, filled, and full view, and then, landscape and portrait orientation and stuff like that. And a lot of that, you could still do snap view, you could still opt into that. But a lot of the rest of it, like, we don't have distinct states anymore. It's really about, supporting a minimum of 500 pixels for your app, and then making sure that you show something meaningful regardless of where you are above that 500 pixels, right? So that's one of the kind of the big changes. There's some of the things that aren't programmer related that I think are a really big deal are like the new store format. So if you go and look at the new Windows 8.1 store, it's much better at surfacing information about your app and about related apps and other apps from the same company, as well as surfacing the ratings information and stuff. And it just looks like a much more professionally done store. And I think the listing is a lot more appealing to people. But also on that same side, we added in support for like stored value, like gift cards and things that folks have been asking for. Like, if you want to be able to provide somebody with money that they can add to the Windows Store and buy them a gift card or something like that, we now have that support, which we didn't in Windows 8. And then one of the things that was sort of snuck in one of the sessions is the 5 machine limit that we've had all along has been changed. Right. So it's not a hard 5 machine limit like we have now, but it's going to be using some kind of machine learning algorithms on server side to make sure that people aren't abusing it. But there is no like set limit at this point. Right now, I'm not sure what will happen once we get out into final release, but it's really nice to know that for people like me, where I've got a desktop and then I've got like 3 work machines and I've got a couple of surfaces and other stuff that I use for demos, it's nice to know I'll be able to use all of those at the same time. So that's a
and the con- the concern with that is server side space to keep all of the why does Microsoft care how many machines I have registered?
Well, think of it as an app developer. Do you as an app developer want somebody to buy an app and give it to a whole classroom full of people, right? There has to be some sort of way of managing that. It's not so much that Microsoft, people at Microsoft do care about it, but it's not so much specifically us as it is looking out for the app developer, right? We want to make sure that app developers, their software isn't just being freely given away to everybody out there, that they can make some money out of it. There are a lot of issues on, Android's a very cool operating system, but when I talk to other developers there, their biggest concern about it is they can't make any money on paid apps because they just get given away or pirated or other stuff. They have to do ad supported apps, and that's basically it. And so we want to make sure that people can make money off paid apps.
Got it. Right? Before we leave the subject, the book is called Windows Store App Development, C# and XAML. It's a Manning Press book. I'm holding it. It is, how many pages is this thing? This is 585 pages.
Yeah, that's positively lean for me. So,
well, it's densely packed. You do cover the topic in detail and in depth, and I highly recommend this book.
Thank you.
But so I think, go ahead. So are you running 8.1 on a lot of your machines?
Yeah, so I've got I haven't foisted it on the rest of my family just yet, but I will soon. The machine that I'm using right now is running 8.1 on it. My main work machine, because I used it for my talk at Build on Windows Store App Promotion, I made sure that had 8.1 on it right there. I upgraded my Surface RT to 8.1, and then I also did my Surface Pro to 8.1 as well. So all but like one of my machines, I think, is running 8.1 at this point.
Well, that's good to hear, because in my excitement, I put 8.1 on my Yoga, which is my demo machine, and I have a demo at CodeStock this coming week, and I did panic slightly about, was that a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, so it is, as developers, I think there's a lot of stuff that we know to look out for. Like, you know, when you first put a new version of an operating system on a device that, you know, not all the drivers will be in Windows Update yet, and like other stuff that you might have to go down and hunt a few things down, stuff that we wouldn't expect consumers to do, which is why it's a preview release. But other than that, I found it really stable. I found it's performing on my main desktop here. It seems to be performing better than what I had for Windows 8, right? And this machine, I'm going to finally rebuild this with the final 8.1 bits, but this is the machine that's gone through, you know, a couple of releases, like the beta plus the final of Windows 7, and then, you know, a beta preview or whatever, I forget which one it was, consumer or whatever, preview of 8. So it seems like 8.1 actually cleared up some of the gunk that was hanging around from several different operating system upgrades. The only thing that I had to do with this is I had to go specifically and download a new NVIDIA driver, because there are some issues where if you are just using the drivers in Windows Update, you might see like little black lines on the screen sometimes. But if you go and download the drivers directly from NVIDIA, they work perfectly. I haven't had an issue since then. So we were going to not talk about the start button, although there are some start page enhancements that I think are very cool. So I never had a big issue with the start button, but as a user of lack of start button, I should say, but as a user of multiple monitors, I did find it hard to get my mouse cursor into the bottom left-hand corner of the screen because I have a monitor to the left, right? So it's sort of like you have to offset by a pixel or two or something to make it hook in there to show that. And so so that was a bit of a pain for me. So in that way, I am glad that there is an actual button there. But what I like even more than that is I use my desktop.
Let me just interrupt you. Is there a difference between the start button and the start key on my keyboard?
Nah, it all does the same thing. Okay. Actually, does the start button always go to the start page? Because the start key will switch between different things. I think they do the same thing.
Okay. Sorry, you were about to say.
Yeah. So the one thing I really like, I had to reboot my brain for a second. The one thing I really like is I use the same wallpaper background for both my start page and my desktop. So there's that issue of that sort of jarring transition that many people pointed out, where when you switch to the start page, it's just like it's completely different. But if you have the same wallpaper background on both, it's like much less, like visually when you're looking at it, it's much less jarring. It's less of a context switch for you. And I found it's a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in making that much more usable. So I was pretty happy with that.
It's funny. I agree. I'd argued with people before that it wasn't jarring. Like, okay, get over it. It's just you're launching an app or whatever. But I do find that very true. Like, it's just kind of, now they feel like little things overlaying your desktop. You know what I mean? It's like a little start launcher that's just kind of like hovering over your desktop rather than switching somewhere.
Yeah.
So you have what you were saying, the same wallpaper is on your desktop mode and on your Windows
start page. Yeah.
Start page.
Like if you go up, if you're on the start page and then you pull up the charms bar and go to settings, and at the top there's a personalize button. I believe that's where you can set that background, and you could say to use the both there. Or you can go in, the super awesome Windows X on the desktop, which brings up all the cool power tools for folks like us. If you do Windows X, it's like one of the options in there somewhere, or right-clicking on the taskbar, one of the two. So,
and when you mentioned Windows X, that's one area I noticed they added a lot too, which is, when people are saying that it's harder to get around, I find Windows 8 to be faster to get around without Windows X. Like there's so much there. So you can hit, you know, Window X and R, or Window X for P, control panel. And, you know, like I can type things in just a few keystrokes, like Window X, P, check updates, down arrow, and I can install my Windows updates or stuff. But now they've added a lot of new things, including like shutdown and all that stuff. So, yeah.
And that was a big thing where, getting to shutdown when you were on the desktop was a bit of a pain. Like I shouldn't have to, sort of mouse and monkey around with that, right? But there are a lot of other little subtle things in there that give desktop love, like better multi-monitor support for one. I mean, that's I don't know how many displays you guys run, but I run two big 30-inch displays, so I'm multi-mon support is a big deal for me. And then as speakers, I mean, we're always projecting or showing different size displays. Being able to have different DPI on each display is also pretty helpful because, you know, I don't normally want to run a Surface Pro at its native resolution because on the desktop, the text is just absolutely tiny. It's not designed for running everything at 100%. But if I connect that up to like a 20-inch screen or something, I want that to be running at just normal 100% DPI. Well, now you can have different DPIs on each display that you work with. That includes like external displays like projectors and stuff. But then there are some things we've done, like just the other day I noticed, this is not something that's ever really brought up as a feature, but again, because I've got this giant kind of low DPI screen here, if I mouse into the corner, the charms bar, if I mouse into the bottom right corner, the charms bar shows up closer to the bottom right corner, right? If I mouse into the top right corner, the charms bar shows up much closer to the top right corner, where it used to always be centered. And I just ran into that the other day, and I was like, oh, well, you know, it's really kind of little things like that that make the whole system feel a lot more polished and a lot better, right?
One of the things that I discovered was I got my Surface, not RT, regular Surface at last build, and liked it very, very much. But for carrying it around and for using it as my entire life is in here, I have to have it with me all the time, it was a little bit awkward. And I obtained a iPad mini, which was perfect. Now that the RT Pro is going to be, or I should say the, yes, RT Pro is
the Surface Pro, like the X86?
I'm thinking more of the Asus, the 8-inch one that's going to be
running. Oh, yes. There's like an Acer Iconia, like the Iconia W3, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's going to have, as I understand it, that's going to have a pen. And that's going to run the Pro version, the full version. I may not have all the details right, but somewhere in there is an iPad contender. You know, yeah. Something that really has that feel, that comfort of bringing it with you all over the place, but also has a full working operating system.
So, although you could run Visual Studio or something like that on that, I don't know that I'm going to run it on an 8-inch screen, right? So, I mean, if you're talking about carrying it around and having your life on it as kind of a companion device.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Not a development device.
Yeah, not like a laptop replacement. Right. So, I mean, iPad was actually pretty late to the game when it came to the 8-inch and 7-inch type devices where there were a bunch of those available on Android, right? So my wife and I both had Kindle Fires, which I know isn't really Android because I can see John grimacing. But that was like her main thing that she always used. She had a laptop and she had a Kindle Fire. So she's looking at some of these 8-inch Windows tablets because they're nicer that she can run all the same apps that she's running on her laptop, which is also a touch device, right? And share all the same information there and have access to her email there. And a lot of other things that you do, like when you're kind of sitting in bed at night reading a book and also want to just quickly check your email or do something like that. So it's a great device for something along those lines. I'm torn in that the Surface with Windows RT is like the perfect size for a lot of what I want to do. I'm actually quite happy with that form factor, but it's close enough to a laptop that you're just like, well, would I just be better off just having a laptop in this case and then or a laptop and an 8-inch device or something like that? I don't know. I haven't decided yet, but I am happy that everything that I have is going to run on both of those and I can do all the same tasks on both.
Yes. Yes. And there are more and more choices, and it'll be very interesting to see what the consumer market makes of all of this and whether people embrace all of these choices or they just get overwhelmed and lost and confused.
We've always had a lot of choice, right? Which, like you're suggesting here, can be a bad thing in terms of helping people make a decision. Like one thing that Apple has is if you go into the store and you're looking at some sort of a tablet, you have like two choices. I mean, maybe they still have the older ones in the stores. I don't know. Right. But you can either go with an 8-inch one or you can go with the, what's a 10.1 or 6-inch or whatever that is. Right. And even now, so it's kind of funny. I've seen anecdotal evidence of people like being torn between which one they should get. Like when people are presented with no choice at all, it's very easy for them to make a decision, right? So when it was an iPad, it's like, fine, that's what I'm going to get. But now that there are two different sizes, that makes it a little harder for them to figure it out. And that now, if you walk into, say, a Microsoft store or a Best Buy or something like that, you look at our stuff and you'll see 100 different devices. And the good thing is you'll probably find something which is an exact match for what you're looking for. But at the same time, you have all that kind of that the bit of overwhelming sense of, wow, there's just so many different things. I'm not sure that I can make a decision on that.
Yes. What it reminds me of is we had friends who had kids staying with them for treatment who had gone through Chernobyl. So they grew up in the Soviet Union. And we used to go into the drugstore and there was, you know, one or two things on the shelves. And we took them into the local CVS where there were 45 brands of toothpaste and they just freaked out.
Right, right.
So, you know, sometimes it can be a little overwhelming, but I wouldn't trade it.
No, I mean,
I have to say, like at Build, they had an area where they had a lot of different devices set out and they're things I just read about mostly. And it was fun to play with all the different form factors. And I was there with Damian Edwards and Scott Hanselman, and we were just poking at them and playing with them. And we liked different ones, you know? I think it was neat to be able to look at and say, you know, well, I like to be able to detach the screen on this, or I think this is a funky idea, but it doesn't work for me. Oh, really? I kind of like it. And so, you know, I mean, I do think that the same operating system, providing it runs well on all of them, you know, is kind of, it does feel nice once you get used to it.
Yep. No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, like I said, it's just a little harder, I think, for folks to make sort of an impulse decision. But if you really want to do the research and get the right thing for you, I think it's much easier because there's so many different ones. I mean, on the stage, they had a touchscreen laptop that was something like $400 or $500 or something like that. You know, there's always been sort of the low end devices that were available, but to have touchscreen at that price point is pretty amazing at this point. Going all the way up to the real expensive ones, which, you know, we all drool over. And then, so the coolest thing on stage I got to play with is the 80-inch Perceptive Pixel screen. So while we're setting up for the keynote, I got to mess around with that and put on, I put up an app that partner's been working on FL Studio Mobile, or excuse me, FL Studio Groove, up on that, and I was playing it on an 80-inch screen. So that was pretty wild. But it's, I'm trying to think of a word that is not empowering because it's such a dorky word here, but it's very cool to have all these different machines and being able to, you know, run your same apps across all of those as an app author or as a consumer, right? And have each of them just know that it's the same stuff that's going to work on every single one of those.
Yes, right? And there's that whole initial experience, which was true with 8.0 and is still with 8.1, which is that you set up your machine and then you go get a new machine and you turn it on and sign in and all of a sudden everything is set up and it's like,
but it's even more so, right? Because now the apps auto update, right? So, and like your start, like when you set up a new machine now, your start page is automatically synchronized, right? And so you'll see all the app placeholders there, but they'll have little icons that indicate they haven't been downloaded yet. And then they'll download in the background. Where if you swipe up or click on the little arrow at the bottom to get to the kind of all apps view on the start page, you'll see the little progress bars for each of the apps as they download and finish installing, which is actually another really cool thing for developers is, by default, don't ever drink seltzer water while you're on a podcast. by default, all the apps will auto update, right? So we no longer have to rely on people going into the store and downloading an update, which nobody did, right? I mean, you know, you see everybody that you know that's not us that has a Windows 8, you look at their store and it had like 56 as the number next to it for like the number of apps that they needed to update on there. But now that's
the equivalent now of the flashing 12 flashing on the VCR.
What I was thinking, 200 million flashing 12 o'clock.
Yeah. So that just happens automatically now, which I think is, again, for app developers, a really big deal because you want to make sure people are getting the right versions so that when they rate your app, they're rating it on the, you know, the latest stuff.
Yes. So let me switch gears on you. You moved your website over to Azure.
I did.
And talk about why and what that was like and how hard that was or easy and what impact it had.
Sure. So I just did that yesterday. It's something I've been meaning to do for a while. I tried it last fall on like really early bits of Windows Azure websites. And I ran into some issues where my website, the domain name starts with a number. It's 10rem.net. And there were some, you know, bugs in the form and stuff last year where if you had a domain name that started with a number, you couldn't actually enter it into the form. And so, you know, I had sent a message to John and to all the Scots that I could find in the gal, because, you know, pretty much all the Scots all work in that one area, and just saying, hey, here, you know, I wanted to move over to Azure and here are the different issues that I ran into. And of course, you know, these guys, they were super responsive with stuff and they fixed a bunch of things and they acknowledged that their internal builds had a bunch of it fixed anyway. But I didn't get a chance to update it again until just now. And the reason I wanted to do this is because for some reason, the area where I live in is always losing power. It's driving me crazy. And I host all my sites and everything internally, or at least I did as a, you know, until yesterday, internally in a rack of servers in my basement, which was a cool experiment at first. But I found out being an IT guy is a really thankless job, and replacing, you know, burned out drives in a RAID server and stuff is not really fun. And, you know, dealing with all the crap with that, not to mention the cost. Like I had to have an air conditioner in that room that was running 24/7, you know, all year round, because those, I was using real servers, which if you've ever used real servers as opposed to just chucking a PC up out there, real servers run hot. They just, they, you know, they're in these racks that don't have a lot of airflow and they like to run super hot. So anyway, so all that stuff had to go. It's like, I'm tired of the power going out and I'm tired of being an IT guy in my house. And I wanted to just get rid of all that and go with a hosted solution. Now, last year I had looked at a bunch of different hosts out there and none of them could really meet. Like, I don't have a Hanselman class blog, but I get a fair bit of traffic on my site. And then, you know, and John's probably seen this type of stuff as well. When you're looking at outside hosters and you have a site like ours, it gets expensive very quickly in, you know, in terms of what they need to do to support the traffic that you get and the, you know, the average bytes downloaded and all that kind of stuff. So what I did do is I finally moved it over to Azure, and I'm using my MSDN benefits as part of that. So that's kind of a nice way to take the top off that. And I'm trying it out right now in a shared instance. So I'm not using the free, I'm using the next step up of Windows Azure websites. The whole thing is Umbraco. So I also had to have a SQL Server instance with that. I set the whole thing up yesterday. I did run into a few issues just with getting the data out of my SQL Server. But that wasn't really Azure related. It was just like, it's remarkably difficult to get data out of a database in bulk, you know, for somebody who's not a full-time DBA. Mm-hmm. It seems like something that should be really simple, like getting data out of a database, but it's not. It's like to get it in a way that's meaningful and can be ported over to something else was actually quite difficult until John hooked me up with, who is it, Scott Klein?
Scott Klein.
Yeah.
Yep.
Who told me, he's like, hey, just download the SQL Server 2012 client side stuff, like the tools, the database management tools. And once I did that and it had an option to export this one thing that's just like a package that has everything in it that I could just have it immediately upload to Azure and then have Azure import it directly, like it was completely hands off. Once I did that, then it all went really smoothly from there. Except for this one. Let's see. How do I want to describe this person? I think idiot might be kind. that I'm dealing with in tech support in my my registrar. So I've used the same registrar forever and ever and ever, and it's not GoDaddy because, you know, GoDaddy's kind of strange that way. But I've been trying to get them to fix a bug on their form, and this is so funny. Like when internally we take bugs, like if you report a bug, it gets logged somewhere, and somebody's going to make a decision, fix it or not fix it, right? When I'm reporting to these guys, like, hey, you have a bug in your form, when I enter the IP address in here, it clears the form and doesn't give me any message. Like, literally, I would hit submit, it would just clear out the field, right? I'm like, this is not useful. You know, there was no message or anything like that. And they're like, all they're focused on is how can they get the final thing working for me? Like they're like, oh, we'll just do it on our end and we'll just fix the stuff behind the scenes. I'm like, no, but at the same time, guys, fix the form. Can you tell me that you've logged a bug to fix? Because there's actually two bugs they had. Can you tell me that you've logged a bug? And I've had like six messages with these people where they don't care about that. They just care about closing out your particular task. I'm like, no, but it's a bug. Fix the bug, right? You know, can you please tell me that yes, you see that there is in fact a bug and you're gonna fix it. And of course they did some crazy things where they, you know, I had to suddenly become very smart on host files, or not host files, zone files and how those are formatted. Like I said yesterday, the internet's not a bunch of tubes. It's actually a whole bunch of very fragile text files that control everything. So I had to be smart about that. But they've managed to mess it up. And like each time I have this conversation with them, they mess it up a bit more. And so it's like, I don't know. Should I just shut up and like not talk to them anymore? Yeah, and it's like, to them. Anyway, so what that means is like really all the issues that I had and the reason why it took me an entire day, which is really not a lot of time when you think about migrating from an on-premise server to something all the way in the cloud. The reason it took me an entire day to get this set up is, you know, waiting for DNS to propagate, getting the data over from my Umbraco database, and then just some very minor tweaks I had to make to web.config because the stuff that I had locally was running an ancient version of .NET, and I decided just to let it go with 4.5 on the Azure instance, but I could have chosen 3.5. Other than that, it was pretty painless. Like it was one of those things, you know, like when you do a compile and it has no errors and you're like, no, I must not have actually done a real compile. Like I must have like, I must have only compiled like this one tiny little thing. So it was the same thing where I just went, I hit the site and it started running. I was like, no. I had to like go shut down my server in the back room, make sure nothing was actually hitting that. And I was just amazed that it worked as smoothly as it did.
And would that process be as smooth for somebody who's running a blog on something like WordPress or one of the other prefab blog software?
Can you run WordPress on Azure?
Yeah, they have support for WordPress on Azure websites. I mean, I do demos. I've done some demos where like in 1 hour I'll launch a Node site, a PHP WordPress site, a ASP.NET site, a classic ASP site, and a PHP site, and do them all on Azure websites in an hour. To do WordPress, you'd probably want to use WebMatrix. They have really good support for like, you know, you can deploy directly from there and you can live edit PHP, which of course is how PHP was meant to be done. You can live edit right on the server. so yeah, it's pretty good.
Isn't that, that's what they call DevOps now, right?
So exactly. Yeah. So it's okay.
Yeah. I think that's kind of funny. We've invented a name to legitimize something that IT guys like forever have been saying, don't do this. Because now managers can say, no, it's DevOps. It's cool. Right. That was the big thing at tech. I'd never heard the term until I spoke at Tech Ed and everybody was talking about it. So I had to go look up. I was like, oh, okay. So the whole Azure migration, and now I'm waiting to see, you know, you have to give it a month, see what your traffic looks like, see what the costs are going to be like and stuff. But I went through the estimation tools. It doesn't look like it's going to be very much. So this could work out quite well. And at least I know it'll be up and running all the time. I don't have to worry about power outages. I don't have to worry about, you know, RAID drives failing, which I've had several fail. Like when you run servers, you know, 24/7 in the back room for years and years and years, you know, the RAID drives tend to be pretty fragile, right? So yes. At least don't have to mess with any of that stuff anymore. So it's kind of like I'm going to put together a blog post on this just to describe some of the things I went through on it. But it was sort of a very mini version of what, you know, any small business or really any company would go through. To move like internal sites or their own web hosting sites over to something like Azure as opposed to hosting it on-premise. So
you can probably take advantage. I'd recommend like scaling down, like using as little as you can and use auto-scale. Yeah. They just announced that a build and that'll scale up as you need it. So
yeah. I mean, I've got my website's running on one shared instance, which gives you something like 768 meg of RAM or something. It's like really not very much. It's kind of funny to throw a number like that and be like, it's not very much. Why my day we had 16K? Anyway, it's like, and it's really easy. Like I was surprised at how many things I can tweak after I've already deployed stuff. Cause like you make all these original initial decisions, like, oh, which size instance or, you know, which size should I do standard? Should I do shared? Should I do free? All these things. Most of those things you can tweak just by a slider afterwards. And I even went back and forth between standard and shared a couple times, which is the difference between sharing a processor and I'm assuming you're in like the same VM or something as other people versus having your own VM. And it's like, It is quite literally just you change a slider and then it like buzzes for a minute or so and then it's done. Mm-hmm. So that's just like there is an amazing amount of complexity being hidden for you just by that little slider.
Yeah, it's cool to be able to do that. And they like spin up the new one and then transfer people over, so there's not even any downtime.
It's yeah. And so my experience with that was good enough that, you know, I wanted to look a lot more into, there's a lot of support in Azure for, you know, client side apps, which is something, I'm not really a web guy. I'm more of a client side guy. So being able to have your apps supported by, you know, services in Azure is a big deal now. And so I want to start messing with that quite a bit more now that I've gone through the initial stuff with Azure and have an account set up and, you know, have something running up there that was actually quite easy to do.
John, we have talked some about, and I'm going to get the name wrong, Windows Mobile Services?
Yeah, Windows Azure Mobile Services.
Windows Azure Mobile Services. Yep. Were there new announcements or new things in that in build, or is that fairly stable?
You know, this is the embarrassing part. Their demo was right after mine, and I was so focused on mine that I always missed their announcement things. The one big thing was that it hit GA, so it's officially released. General availability, I guess, is the thing. There are some other things you can do, like you can. They had triggers essentially that you'd write in JavaScript that, like, when something's added to or changed in your data, because it's essentially like a dynamic database in the cloud, and you could write little JavaScript-based triggers that say, like, when data is inserted, add this other row here, or tweet this thing, or do whatever. And the neat but downside part was that you were editing right in a web form. So it was like a text area, and it did all the autocomplete, and it looked really neat, but you're editing in a web page. And they said, you know, in real life, people that are running our apps on these things want to source control it. So now it like hooks in with source control, and you can edit in Visual Studio, and when you save, it publishes it. It's really pretty slick. So that's kind of the main thing.
We'll come back to the topic, but I'm keeping my eye on the push notification and how easy they do or don't make push notifications for applications, because the theory is that Azure Mobile Services should make push notifications just a line or two of code, and I'm really hoping that there's a reality behind that.
The small bit I've seen, and I'm sure Pete can correct me here, but the small bit I've seen is that they make it as simple as possible, but supporting push notifications in a Windows app or a Windows phone app takes some work to get all that authentication stuff set up. So once that's set up, it really is just like a line or two of code.
Yeah, I think a bunch of that was done, you know, through submitting your app, like when you register for push notifications and stuff there. But the API client side, if I remember right, was really very simple, right? There wasn't a whole lot of work required to do that.
Although one issue that I have definitely run into, at Telerik, we're talking a lot to folks about Windows 8 as an enterprise solution for line of business applications. And unfortunately, at least so far, and I think it's true in 8.1 as well, push notifications require that it be a Windows Store application, not a sideloaded or other internal application.
So I don't keep up with enterprise stuff as much as I used to, but I thought we had, so I'm just checking here really quick. I thought we had something to make that easier. Maybe not. Now this post here doesn't have everything in it, but I thought that was possible, but I, you know, don't quote me on that because it may not be the case, but yes, at least in Windows 8, it had to be a Windows Store app in order to use push notifications, and people found ways to, you know, sort of finagle their apps that way where they kind of did a listing, but didn't submit it to the store or some other weird stuff like that. There were workarounds. But I know it's something that's on everybody's radar. I'm just not sure if there are changes in Windows 8.1 to make that easier.
Well, another time, I would very much like to have you come back, Pete, and talk specifically about the topic of line of business applications with Windows 8.1. That's near and dear to my heart, and Microsoft has done a killer job on making the case for consumer apps, but I would argue a little bit less on making the case for line of business app.
Yeah, and I mean, and that was true in Windows 8, and there are an awful lot of just like operating system level enhancements in 8.1 to make it more enterprise friendly. It's kind of the same thing we did with the phone, where, you know, when Windows Phone was first released, it was all consumer driven, And if you think about it from like a marketing standpoint and just like a product lifecycle standpoint, if you're going on fairly rapid release cycle of say like, you know, a full rev every year, then it makes a lot more sense to target consumer first because enterprises aren't buying the stuff right when it comes out. Typically, they're usually waiting, you know, 3 years or whatever that magic number is before they adopt the technology. But consumers are the ones who will go to the store and buy it on day one, or, you know, kind of wait in line outside the store to get the stuff right when it comes out. So it's not that we have no plans to support, you know, enterprise stuff in Windows 8.1. It just, or in Windows 8 in general, it just that it wasn't the first thing in the box.